There was a family that had lost a grandma who decided that they needed to view the body before the funeral. The parents didn't really know anyone in the town where the grandma lived to look after their young son after they'd travelled there. So they decided that, properly briefed, he would go into the viewing with them, explaining carefully beforehand that though grandma was in heaven, they still wanted to see her actual body. They arrived at the undertaker's and went into the chapel of rest set aside for such viewings, noticing that their son was far more interested in checking out the room itself than his late grandmother's body. What had been going on in his mind, though, became clear when he eventually said, rather disappointedly, "So this is heaven." I guess that those taking part in our home groups will probably have had a rather clearer idea of what Christians mean by heaven even before starting the course. And our reading focuses on the related subjects: what becomes of a believer's body after they die? Many people assume that after death, any thought of our needing a body is as much a misunderstanding as that little boy's thinking. The presumption being that our final destiny is as disembodied spirits in heaven, like the angels may be, some people even speaking of our becoming that kind of supernatural being after we die. Or maybe they use the language of souls. The ancient Greek philosophers spoke of all human souls as being immortal, and a number of important Christian thinkers have rather uncritically borrowed that language. The New Testament writers, though, were convinced that the final destiny promised to Christian believers had much more substance to it than that. That there will come a day when we are each raised from death as Jesus was and given new bodies as he was as well. Although that teaching wasn't immediately accepted by everyone in the early church, which is why Paul's first letter to the Corinthians devotes a whole long chapter to explaining things in more detail. Our first reading coming from the second half of that chapter 15. Many of us be rather more familiar with the chapter's earlier verses, in which the Apostle Paul lays out all the supporting evidence for the Lord Jesus' bodily resurrection on the first Easter Sunday, identifying it as one of the non-negotiable core elements of the Christian faith. But actually, even that material isn't primarily intended to assure Paul's readers of the reality of Jesus being raised, helpful though it is on that front for us. Paul only talks about Jesus' resurrection on this occasion to respond to church members who didn't believe that they would one day be bodily raised. In his understanding, if you didn't believe in a general resurrection, then Jesus' resurrection had no real place or purpose. If there is no resurrection of the dead, verse 13, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. To us, Jesus' resurrection from the dead can look rather like an isolated miracle. A little bit like the half dozen other Bible accounts of people coming back from the dead, but with the key difference that Jesus wasn't just miraculously revived to enjoy a few extra years, but rather raised to a new kind of life, never to die again. Paul's insistence, though, is that there's much more to it than that. This is merely God's prototype for the new life that will one day come to all believers. You may know the story of the man who's just got on a motorway when he's alarmed to see a car travelling in the opposite direction. He gets onto the hard shoulder and calls the traffic police to alert them. Halfway through his description, though, he adds, "Actually, it's not just one car, it's hundreds of them all driving the wrong way." And Paul sees a future in which the resurrection of Jesus is just the first of many similar resurrections, describing the risen Jesus as the first fruits. Imagine you discover a pack of seeds, and despite your best efforts, you can't work out what they are. Well, you could just throw them away, or you could plant them all and hope for the best. But then you wouldn't necessarily have planted them in the best kind of soil or have left far too much or too little spacing between them. So instead you decide to plant one of them and see what it develops into. Then the first fruits coming from that seedling can tell you what to expect of all the others. Well, in this case, the gardener is God, who knows exactly what's going on. But one key purpose of his raising of Jesus is to show all of his followers what we can expect in the future. We experience many elements of the new birth and the new life that he offers here and now, but not all that is promised by any means. And the resurrection of Jesus isn't only wonderful in itself. It shows what is still to come for you and me if we're the Lord's followers. We know from the accounts of the first Easter in the Gospels that Jesus' resurrection body has both similarities and differences from his earthly body. Strong similarities because in the end, the disciples had no difficulty in unanimously believing that it was the Lord risen from the grave. As we saw a couple of weeks ago, he invites Thomas to touch his hands and his side. And then last week, he's reported as starting a fire to cook and serve some of the disciples a fish breakfast. At the same time, though, there are differences. At times, the risen Jesus isn't immediately recognized. He joins them from nowhere when they're gathered behind locked doors, and on occasions disappears just as mysteriously. And Paul is clear that means that though this glorious future promised to every believer includes a body, it isn't the same thing at all as our present bodies. He again uses a horticultural metaphor to describe the way they relate, in describing our present bodies as like a seed. The first similarity being that death is a necessary part of the process of bringing these future plans into being. Second part of verse 36. What you sow does not come to life unless it dies. With our 21st century biological knowledge, we might not describe the germination of a seed underground as its death, usually. But once that process has happened, the actual seed is no longer recoverable. You can't harvest the crop that's been produced, then go back to the ground and recover and reuse the seed that made it, because it doesn't exist anymore. And in the same kind of way, our resurrection body are in some kind of way seen as emerging from the dying of our earthly bodies. That, I presume, is why the tomb of Jesus was discovered to be empty on the first Easter Sunday morning. The second parallel between the making of our resurrection bodies and the growth of a new plant, well, just as a plant will generally have many differences from the seed that produces it, so the resurrection body that we is in many ways different from the earthly body that we inhabit now. Paul makes the point that in his day, the term body could be used to describe not only human bodies, but also animal bodies and what we call celestial or heavenly bodies, like the moon or the stars or the sun. Each of them, Paul says, has a different kind, a different level of glory, putting quite a focus on the glory of the sun, the moon, and the different stars. It may be that the part of their special glory that he has in mind comes from their relative permanence. Of course, people like Paul living in the first century had only a tiny fraction of the scientific knowledge that we possessed. But what they had grasped was that whereas each biological life, and most poignantly each human life, would within a fairly small number of years come to an end, the sun, moon, and stars had been and would be around for a whole lot longer. And it's clear to Paul that points to another important difference between our present bodies and the resurrection body, which was given to the risen Jesus and which will one day be bestowed on all of his followers. Verse 42, what is sown is perishable, what is raised is imperishable. It is sown in dishonour, it is raised in glory. Despite what Paul has said about the glory of all bodies, including the glory of our earthly human body, he uses some tough words to describe its limitations. Perishable, first of all, which might make you and I seem of no more significance than a rotting piece of fruit. The majority of us have already discovered the reality of the best before dates on our human bodies, and it's only a matter of time before we will each reach the use-by date they carry as well. Paul adds to the reality check when he describes our earthly human bodies as being sown in dishonour. And the sobering fact is that much as we seek to honour the bodies of those we've loved and lost, they have come to an end of their practical usefulness. Our perishable human bodies are, to pick out the third word Paul uses, sown in weakness. But he doesn't give us that reality check to discourage us, but rather to highlight the wonder of the Christian hope, of the contrasting glories of the resurrection bodies that we're promised. So will it be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown is perishable, it is raised imperishable. It is sown in dishonour, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. Paul is clear that the limitations of our earthly bodies mean they cannot be part of God's final plans for his kingdom. That's because what's promised for the believer isn't just that we go to heaven, but that in time we'll be part of his new creation here on earth. Our world completely remade without any of its current imperfections and pains and perishability. And it stands to reason that, as he puts it, the perishable, that is our perishable bodies that we have here and now, cannot inherit the imperishable. But rather than discourage us, the process of death and in time resurrection is seen as representing a wonderful exchange. Listen, I tell you a mystery. We will not all sleep, but we will all be changed in a flash, in a twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, the dead will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed. For the perishable must clothe itself with the imperishable, and the mortal with immortality. When the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory. I'm aware, even if we were to look in detail at all that this chapter says, and other parts of the Bible too, many questions unanswered. For example, what is this resurrection body made of? What exactly happens to us between the day we die and resurrection day when Jesus returns? Or maybe we're just wondering whether believing all that the Bible teaches on this front is just too much of a stretch. Well, that surely is one of the key reasons why the events of the first Easter happened. To demonstrate through the raising of Jesus what God is able to do with us after we die. And to give us in the risen Christ a preview, if you like, of the resurrection bodies that are promised to all of his followers.